Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us for this, the 100th podcast that we've recorded since we started producing them in February 2017, approximately 1,500 days ago. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute, and I'm joined by my colleagues today, Bassam Fatou, Jim Henderson, Michael Maiden, and Anupama Sen. Now, in this podcast, I've asked my colleagues to reflect back over the period since we recorded the first podcast and ask the question as to, what may we be discussing over the next 100 podcasts? So, if I may start with Bassam Fatou, who is director of the OIES. Now, in February 2017, Bassam, the oil price was $56.25, and today it's over $70, which to my mind seems pretty similar. But I don't think that really tells the whole story of the past 4 years. So I suppose my question to you, Bassam, is are there any lessons that we can learn from this period of extreme volatility for the future? What do you think, Bassam?
First of all, David, thank you for having me. It has really been a roller coaster for oil markets during the last 4 years. Of course, the oil market is not strange to severe shocks. But the COVID-19 shock was really something special in terms of its size and how it affected almost every aspect of demand, both across geographies and products. And this severe shock really revealed some lessons. And I will just mention a few to try to keep my response short. I think a key lesson is that despite the massive shock, oil markets continue to function efficiently, which shows the maturity of oil markets. At the start of the COVID-19 shock, when supplies exceeded demand, the market allocated excess supply into on-land and floating storage facilities, and the time spreads and price differentials adjusted to send signals allowing efficient trade flows of both products and crude, but also send signals to producers to cut production. As economies are opening up and demand started recovering, these stocks are being released to the market. It's true that the shock exposed some of the weaknesses of the benchmark. And we have written here at the Institute many articles on the topic. But the benchmark dislocations were short-lived. Another lesson, David, is despite the size of the shock to the global economy and the restriction on people's movement, which is unprecedented, in 2020, we estimate oil demand to have stayed at around 91 million barrels per day. And as economies are opening, the demand has been recovering towards the pre-shock level. This has implications on the way we think about the energy transition. Some of the projections see oil demand falling to 50 million barrels per day by 2050 or even lower. This really raises the issue of the size of adjustments in the economy, population, technology, finance, that are required to reach these levels. People seem to underappreciate the scale of the challenge. Another lesson regards OPEC Plus. OPEC Plus cuts have been essential to bring back markets into balance. People have declared the death of OPEC multiple times, not perhaps realizing that OPEC works best in face of negative shocks. Also, despite all of their differences, in a face of a shock, producers eventually do get together. And during this shock, this happened fairly quickly. The performance of OPEC Plus in terms of compliance, but also managing the market, I would say this has been a distinguishing feature of this cycle. Another lesson, David, is regarding U.S. shale. The weakness of the U.S. shale business models were building up over time. And the U.S. shale response to the COVID-19 shock was sharp and fast this time. The recovery in the U.S. shale is also proving to be slower than many are expecting. So the idea that U.S. shale is an alternative to spare capacity and that it can be switched on and off fairly quickly, I believe this is no longer and was never valid. Just a couple of more lessons, David, if you allow me, is China's influence on the oil market, which has been increasing. But during this shock, its role has been elevated to a new level. China proved to be an important absorber of the shock by absorbing massive amounts of crude into storage facilities. And final thought, which I could add here, is this disconnect between the short-term and long-term expectations about the role of oil in the energy mix. In the same day, you could read stories about the start of a super cycle in oil, which is super bullish, and at the same time, demand is peaking or has already peaked, which is super bearish. In a way, this will have implications on the nature of the cycle. The oil market is prone to cycles, but these cycles could become more severe as we progress.
Well, I must say, Bassam, you know, in those few minutes, you've summarized, I think, why the oil market is so interesting because of all the changes that we've seen over the last few years. But what do you think the main topics are that may be subject to the next 100 podcasts, say, over the next 2 to 3 years? What do you think?
Well, the usual short-term issues such as the pace of demand recovery, OPEC Plus, Saudi oil policy, U.S. shale, geopolitics, inventories, market balances, we will continue to monitor those. You know, these are the usual suspects, really. I think another interesting topic will be the rationalization in the refining sector in some parts of the world, such as Europe and the U.S., and the resulting shifts in crude and product trade flows. Also, China's evolving role in oil markets in the light of the carbon neutrality pledge. Longer term, I think people will continue to try to project when oil demand will peak, but more generally, the role of oil in the energy mix. There will be much more focus on the geopolitical implications of the energy transition at what it means for different countries, particularly oil exporters. There will be continued focus on the transformations in the transport sector, battery technology, electric vehicles, shared mobility, autonomous vehicles, and the implications of these trends on oil demand. I think another issue, David, is the ESG and investment and financing of oil project will also attract a lot of attention. Also, the strategies of international companies as they transition to net zero business models would be interesting to look at. Also, the adaptation strategies for oil exporters during the energy transition and whether they will make progress in their diversification efforts. And here I would say that the role of the CCUS and policies for enabling mitigation strategies based on carbon sinks and whether these could help the role of oil in the energy mix. Certainly at the Institute, we'll be doing a lot of work in this area.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you the obvious question, Bassam. I'm not going to ask you to predict oil prices over the next 3 years. But what do you think the price trend will be?
Actually, David, one of the lessons that I did not mention in response to your first question is that oil market observers and analysts are particularly not good at predicting prices. The swings from optimism to pessimism and vice versa among the analyst community is really phenomenal. Those who were predicting doom and gloom a few months ago are now predicting $100 oil price. Sometimes it feels that there is competition between who can predict the highest or the lowest. So, David, I will not be making prediction about the oil price, but let me make a couple of quick observations and respond indirectly to your question. I would say that much of the debate on the energy transition and the way expectations and behaviors are shifting so fast, much faster than the actual changes in the energy mix, this could contribute to dislocations and could make the price cycles sharper, both on the upside and the downside. But it also could make the cycles not very far apart. The other thing I would say that there is a misconception that peak demand, if and when it happens, that this will necessarily mean lower and ever declining oil prices. Actually, this may or may not be the case. We could well have demand peaking or plateauing and still have higher prices.
Well, look, thank you very much, Bassam, for your time today and kind of your view of what we've seen and hopefully what we're going to see. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David, for having me.
So if we move on to the views of Jim Henderson, director of the gas program at the Institute. Now, Jim, you know, in fact, you recorded the first podcast that was published on the 21st of February 2017, which was titled Russian Oil Production Outlook to 2020. But you are director of the gas program. So let's talk about the changes that you've seen in the gas sector since 2017. So perhaps why don't we start with the traditional market features like supply, demand, and prices?
Well, it's certainly been a volatile time since 2017. Obviously, we've seen the surge in LNG supply we've seen, which caused prices to start to fall around 2018, 2019. And then we obviously saw the impact of the COVID pandemic, which saw demand curtailed somewhat in 2020 and very low prices. And now, of course, we've seen the rebound as economies start to get going again. And I think within that rebound, we're seeing one of the major themes, which is the continuing rise in Asian gas demand, which has really been, you know, the big driver of the gas sector over the past few years, with China at the forefront, of course. And you know, we're going through a period now of having seen a lot of LNG supply coming onto the market, an element of tightness, and as a result, prices are rising. So I think, you know, the traditional supply and demand forces have been very much in evidence over the past 3 or 4 years. We've seen the reaction in prices, and of course, had the you know, some other external factors layered on top of that. But I think you know, plus ça change, as you say, and no doubt we'll be seeing more of the same over the next few years as well.
I think you're right. But of course, decarbonized gas has become a major topic of debate over the past few years as well. So, what are the key themes there which the OIS is focusing on?
Well, I think that's really been the major change, actually, if you look at what's been happening since the first podcast in 2017 to now. I mean, underlying trends in the gas market have continued, but really the focus has come on to how gas can find a role in the energy transition. I think Jonathan Stern, our colleague, really brought this up at around the time of that first podcast, actually, and you know, calling on the gas industry to address its position. Coal to gas switching has obviously been a major theme in Europe and is now becoming a major theme in Asia, and had a huge role to play in the United States as well, actually. But I think that story, certainly in OECD countries, is starting to have been played out. And the theme now is, you know, gas is almost, in some regions, particularly Europe, becoming part of the problem. So the question is, how does gas decarbonize? You know, over the last 2 years, hydrogen has become a major theme. And I get a lot of the debate now is, how could a hydrogen economy emerge? What forms of hydrogen, whether it be blue from steam reforming of methane, green from renewable electricity, you know, or sources such as, you know, electricity fired by nuclear or pyrolysis, all these different forms of hydrogen supply. And then, of course, on the flip side, where's the demand? And, you know, how can the hydrogen be transported from the sources of supply to demand? Is it shipping? Is it pipelines? Do we have a full hydrogen grid? Is it a localized market? All these questions are now being debated, as well as what regulations are needed. That debate is, you know, at its peak, I would say, in Europe, but is also starting to expand across the rest of the world. We've seen Japan importing hydrogen from Saudi Arabia. We've seen the emergence of ammonia as a potential source of transporting hydrogen in a liquid form. So really lots and lots of movements. And in the background, still the ongoing debates around biogas and biomethane and other forms of synthetic gas. They haven't got quite the attention that hydrogen has, but they're still there. And if you look at some of the scenarios that are being painted by the IEA and indeed by ourselves, you know, those gases obviously also have a role. But really, hydrogen is the topic of the moment, and I'm sure will be the topic of many podcasts to come.
Okay, so let's talk about the future podcasts, because more generally on the energy transition, you know, how do you see the main topics developing for, let's say, the next 100 podcasts?
Well, I think there's a number of key themes. I think the first I should probably highlight, given that we've had a paper out on it recently, is carbon. So I think there'll be a lot of discussion around carbon markets, about, you know, whether carbon markets can emerge globally, and on whether regions such as the EU can force the issue a little bit with things like a carbon border adjustment mechanisms, and what impact that has on you know, global suppliers of all forms of energy and indeed products overall. So I think there's that. Then there's the question of carbon offsets and carbon capture and storage. So will carbon credits be traded? And so there are all sorts of topics around carbon markets and related topics. I think there'll be a lot around the interaction between gas and electricity, circular economies, you know, whether they be circular carbon economies, circular energy economies, but the interaction between different sectors. And you know, the need to talk about an integrated energy system. So I think there'll be a lot of discussion around that. And then, you know, on the energy transition more generally, There's, of course, all questions around financing. I think financing is going to be a huge topic, particularly as we come towards COP26. I think that the financing of transition in developing economies by developed economies is going to be a major theme. And I think, added to that and allied to that, the geopolitics of the energy transition is also going to be really interesting as we see whether there will be winners and losers and, or if that whole concept of winners and losers is a useful one, because basically at the end of the day, we've all got to cooperate to make this work. And so I think that, the debate around how countries and regions interact over energy transition will be a very, very vital topic. And I think that, all those topics coming together, at the end of the day, the other key question I think we'll be asking at the Institute, coming back to our historic role as a kind of hydrocarbon analyzer, is how do we think about all these scenarios? I mean, I think the IEA net zero scenario has had a lot of press recently, and a few people have been taking that as a sort of, the only way we can move forward. At the Institute, we're thinking about, are there other ways that we can move forward in the energy transition, which may involve more or less hydrocarbons, more or less offsetting and carbon capture and storage? Can we think about different routes which can accommodate not just Europe, but, the aspirations of all countries around the world, whether they be importers or exporters of hydrocarbons at the moment?
Well, great, Jim. Fantastic insights. I certainly look forward to the next 100 podcasts with you. And thank you very much indeed for joining us today.
Thanks, David. It's a pleasure.
If we can move on to the views of Mikhail Maidan, who's director of the China Programme at the Institute. Mikhail, one country that's become centre stage in the sector, I should say, so more than in early 2017, is China. So what changes have you seen since then? And what about the future?
First of all, of course, OIS didn't have a China programme back in 2017. That was reflected in our podcast. But just in terms of China, I was looking back at some of the statistics in the BP Energy Review. And, I have to say, some things haven't changed, right? Back then, China was the largest energy growth market globally. It had been for 17 years consecutively. Largest market for oil, gas, renewables, and also coal. And it was a disappointing reversal after 3 years of decline. Now, today, of course, China is still the biggest consumer of energy globally. But, of course, it has an outsized impact. Part of it is because of COVID, and part of it is because of China's ongoing economic expansion sort of relative to the rest of the world. So, back in 2017, oil demand growth was double that of the US. In 2020, China sort of oil demand grew well above any other country when demand elsewhere fell. Now, interestingly, for gas markets, China had been and remains one of the largest growing markets. In 2017, if we look at the statistics, and I'm going to finish with the statistics in a second, domestic production accounted for a third of demand growth. Last year, it was more than half of China's needs, reflecting, I think, this rising concern with energy security. So perhaps if I sum it up, it's obviously remained a key actor globally, but its weight has increased. And so has the domestic concern about energy security and other events, including US-China and Trump and COVID, has meant that China is looking at a much more hostile external environment today, and that is impacting its energy choices. And that was, of course, in part behind the most transformative event, not just in the past 3 years, but I think really in the past decade and for the future, and that's the 2060 carbon neutrality pledge.
Interesting. Well, look, technology advancement, which you and I have talked before many times on podcasts, is an important part of the energy business. But we've seen this as a critical part of China's strategy. So I expect my question to you is this a trend that we're likely to see more in China, particularly as part of the energy transition?
Absolutely. Technology is at the heart of a number of policy priorities, especially in light of the sort of context that we've just discussed. I mean, the 14th five-year plan and the 2035 visions, and of course the 2060 pledge, are emphasizing electrification, and the technological needs are both in terms of sort of what we've been calling the hardware of new renewables capacity and grid connections and nuclear and storage and hydrogen, but also the software, right? The demand side management, the apps, the smaller, so to speak, innovation. All of that is part of kind of China's long-term trajectory as China advances its energy transition. I think the question going forward is, can China play the role in new breakthrough technologies that it did for the kind of first generation of technology, such as PV, solar and batteries? We've written a lot about this. We've discussed this in podcast, how sort of China's ability to scale up technologies was transformative for the energy transition, but it was through incremental innovation and global supply chains. And with this more competitive global outlook and concerns about technological decoupling, can China scale up technologies now? Will it look more inward in its technological innovation? Or will it still try to capture global markets? Or will it be a South-South kind of, you know, will it look more to developing markets to sell technologies? So I think we're looking at a much more complex technological environment.
So why do we look forward now to the next 2 or 3 years, or as I'm calling it in this recording, the next 100 podcasts? What do you think the main topics will be that we'll be talking about?
You know what they say, plus ça change. I think we will continue to discuss the paradox of China's coal addition alongside these phenomenal gains in renewables. We will analyze the slow progress, I think, from a Western perspective on market reforms in the context of a very strong state-owned sector. We'll look at China's pricing power in oil markets, and I think we'll debate the relevance of that experience for gas markets and whether China will become an active price maker. Obviously, it is a price maker just by its sheer size, but whether it will start determining hubs and prices in gas markets too. But more and more, I think we will look at the governance of the energy transition in China. We will debate the kind of various policy priorities, whether they help or hinder the transition, and to what extent they are a model for other countries, and how they impact other countries' transitions.
Well, Mikhail, thank you very much indeed for your contribution to this, the 100th podcast. Thank you. So now let's talk to Annapurna Sen, who's director of the electricity program at the Institute. Annapurna, could we start with the electricity sector, which has arguably been at the forefront of the energy transition, being really the first sector to experience significant change, particularly in Europe. How do you see that change panning out in emerging market countries as the energy transition progresses?
Well, David, as you correctly said, Europe has been at the forefront of the transition, particularly in electricity. And most countries that have decarbonized in Europe have done it through decarbonizing their electricity sectors and replacing fossil fuels with renewables. In doing so, we have seen numerous challenges arise, such as those related to, you know, the introduction of zero marginal cost renewables into a market originally designed for fossil fuels with relatively higher marginal costs, as well as the need for increased flexibility of the electricity system to balance this variability of renewables. But these challenges aren't new. The last major iteration of electricity market liberalization and reform, which is also called the standard model of electricity reform, also had its flaws, such as a lack of alignment of incentives between participants in the wholesale energy market and in the retail supply market. Now, most emerging market economies like India, China, and other non-OECD Asian countries have adopted some form of the standard model that was pioneered in Europe, but they have needed to try and adapt it to become more context specific. And this adaptation to context will continue to be a challenge as emerging markets decarbonize their own power sectors, starting from very different starting points. So in emerging markets, the challenges are most likely to be around the pricing of energy in a cost-reflective manner, taking into account environmental externalities. And of course, the political economy of energy sector reforms is another context-specific issue that will continue to have an impact in emerging market economies' efforts to decarbonize. Although we could also argue there is political consensus now on the need for climate change mitigation policies to be a core part of that. So that's broadly how I think these things and these challenges will pan out in emerging market economies.
Well, look, why don't we specifically talk about India a minute? Post-COVID, how do you think the country will approach the energy transition? Will the move away from coal finally happen? And will India's international gas trading business grow? What are your views?
Well, India is facing a lot of challenges post-COVID. It is going to take time to vaccinate its population, and current targets put this at has happening at the end of this year. But we know how unpredictable the situation is at the moment with the emergence of new variants and other issues. So I think climate change mitigation will continue to be an important element of Indian energy transition policy. But I think other issues like energy security, and by that I mean the fiscal security of energy supplies, will also play a critical role. And this is both a positive and a negative for the energy transition. It's positive because renewables are particularly suited to fiscal security objectives, some would argue, since they offer the potential to lower the need for hydrocarbon imports. But it's also negative because coal is a plentiful domestic resource in India, as we know. So I don't see coal disappearing from India's energy mix. And I think a lot more will need to be done to facilitate a transition away from it, not just in terms of domestic pricing and distribution issues, but also the access to the financing that's needed to support the energy transition in India. Now, the future of natural gas in India in the medium term, whether it will grow substantially in the energy mix from where it is now, and specifically to what levels, is still a bit unpredictable and a bit of a puzzle. Because on the one hand, gas can offer significant emissions reduction by enabling a switch away from coal, but the infrastructure needed to enable this is substantial. And on the other hand, we know that in the longer term future, there's unlikely to be room for unabated gas. So any gas will need to be decarbonized eventually. I think over the last 6 to 8 years, India has gained prominence as a key player in the international gas market through its strategic policies on buying from the spot market or on seeking contract renegotiations and so forth. And I think that this will continue, but we have yet to see what scale it will reach.
Yeah, yes, it's a matter of scale. Of course, India's so huge, isn't it? One small change can have a huge impact on scale. Well, look, why don't we kind of finish up this podcast by asking you the question I've been asking the others. And that is, you know, what do you think the main topics will be in the subject line of the next 100 podcasts that we do in the OIES, let's say over the next 2 to 3 years?
You know, David, I wish I had a crystal ball even to be able to see into the next 6 months, let alone the next 3 years. I mean, I would say we're undoubtedly in the midst of a very exciting and interesting period, and some would argue a period of unprecedented change for the energy sector. So I think energy will be increasingly viewed through the lens of a whole system, rather than in separate silos, such as separate vectors like oil, gas, electricity, etc., as the transition progresses. And the types of questions that researchers will be working on will have implications beyond the immediate subject matter that they relate to. So broadly speaking, areas such as the pricing of externalities, how to achieve efficient decarbonization of the entire economy, the impact of rising electrification on all the energy vectors and energy sectors, the adoption of circular economy approaches, the role of energy networks in the transition, the governance of the transition, and on and on. I think these are broadly the areas that I would pick. And of course, we mustn't forget the impact of the economics of energy on the geopolitics of energy. And I suspect we will see a lot more podcasts on that topic as well as the transition gains momentum.
Well, you've given us a huge insight, as indeed all of you today on this podcast, this slightly different podcast, I have to say, as we celebrate our number 100 today. And so I'd just like to say thank you very much indeed for you for listening at home, and also for my 4 people who have interviewed here today. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.